as the first of the 1930s treaty battleships to actually be built, the French Dunkirk class are at times largely forgotten, in part because of their relative inactivity in World War II, and other times they come under criticism, some of it ill-informed, when they're compared to other capital ships of the period. So today, we're going to look at the ships in a little bit more detail, particularly why and how they came about, and what factors would influence the final design that actually got built. To set the stage fully, we need to go back all the way to the start of World War I and the last French battleships that would be built before the Dunkirks. Back then, the Marine Nationale was in the process of finishing off the construction of the Britannias, and they just started construction on the Normandies. This latter design, with an impressive, for the time, main battery of a dozen 340mm guns and three quadruple turrets, nonetheless reflected the severe limitations the Marine Nationale faced at this time, and indeed had faced for most of the era of steam and steel, namely infrastructure. With an enforced break in major warship construction after the Franco-Prussian War, and a degree of slow build-up after that, in part thanks to the temporary adoption of the Jeune Ecole, France's maritime infrastructure when it came to the construction of large warships had fallen behind by quite a way, and multiple generations of French warships were therefore constrained, in part, by the size of available docks to build and maintain them in. This had been true at the start of the pre-dreadnought period, and it was true now. Although some expansion work had taken place in between those times, budgetary restrictions, and in an ironic twist, France's long and proud naval legacy, had limited this to infrastructure that was just big enough to cope with the demands of whatever was the current or immediately forecast set of ships to be built. And of course, when a new generation came along that was bigger, they were back to square one. For all its coastline, France actually has remarkably few places that are suitable for major maritime infrastructure relative to the length of that coast, and naturally pretty much all of these had been heavily built up centuries ago. Combined with the age of sail habit of building shipyards in estuaries or slightly up rivers rather than directly fronting to the sea, which of course meant their own width limitations for launching ships, expanding a dockyard into a city that was centuries or even millennia old would be extremely difficult and expensive, not to mention that it would likely cut through other related infrastructure, such as warehouses and factories, that tended to sit right behind the slipways, dry docks, and graving docks in question. In fact, a good number of these facilities would actually be expanded with the highly unusual step of building further out into the sea, where passage would allow. Thus, in 1914, there were a grand total of 5 graving docks in all of France that could accommodate the Normandies. 2 of them were in Brest and 3 were in Toulon. And for both of the former and one of the latter, it was a case of only just. Fitting a Normandy class into those docks would leave so little space that a normal person would be able to jump aboard at either the bow or stern of the ship from the lip of the dock, with a total clearance of just under 5 feet, or about 2.5 feet at either end, at which point an especially tall man could just as easily step aboard. The 2 larger Toulon docks had a more generous 83-foot total clearance, but even these were causing issues as their size dictated the choice of design for and length of the Normandy successors, the Lions, which were supposed to be ordered the following year in 1915. Those ships would not fit into the 3 smaller docks, and they only left about 20-foot total clearance in the larger ones. Now, to be fair, work had started in both ports on a pair of larger 250-metre or 820-foot long graving docks in each location, and another similar single dock was also under construction in Cherbourg. But by the end of World War I, some ships in other nations were either under construction or about to enter service, and they were considerably larger than even those docks' dimensions. The last British, American, and Japanese battleships would only fit in these 5 new docks, and their battle cruisers, the Amagi, Lexington, Hood, and G3 types, wouldn't fit in any of them. Of course, France wasn't planning on hosting any of those ships, but those restrictions had major implications for the Marine Nationale's capacity to keep up with foreign designs. And with limited budgets in the post-war period, to try and bring the Corbets and Britannias up to a degree of competitiveness, the call for the Washington Naval Treaty, or the conference that would eventually lead to it, was welcomed with sighs of relief across most of France's naval and maritime society. Unfortunately, while curbing the seemingly runaway spiral of the UK-US-Japan naval arms race, which threatened to leave France a decade or more behind, the Washington Naval Treaty also proposed a 10-year freeze on capital ship construction, which would leave the Marine Nationale's battle line a generation or two behind everybody else in what the treaty had clearly established as the currency of naval power, namely the battleship. With their global empire, but difficult financial position, France had already accepted that she would be behind the US and British fleets. But at this point, she still considered herself to be somewhat above Italy and on a par with Japan as far as her place at the world table went. And so it was hoped to argue for an allocation of 350,000 tons worth of battleships, equivalent to 10 new ships at the new 35,000 ton per ship displacement limit. She was also prepared to adopt a fallback position of 280,000 tons, equivalent to 8 brand new ships, plus no restriction on submarines, which, in a callback to the Je Nicole, France was already planning to use to make up for the lack of strength in her battle line. However, it turned out that Britain and America were far more concerned about boxing Japan into a corner, and after some debate and negotiation on that particular point, the French delegation was summarily informed that they would be allowed 175,000 tons of battleships, the equivalent to 5 new 35,000-ton ships. This would be the same as Italy, and half of what Japan was allowed, based on a calculation that largely ran off of what hulls France and Italy actually had in the water at that point that could be reasonably counted as at least somewhat modern. For the French, that was the 4 Corbets and 3 Britannias, although they were initially allowed to also hold on to a trio of Danton-class semi-dreadnoughts, even though this technically put them at 221,000 tons, as the Dantons weren't seen as particularly combat-effective against something like a Queen Elizabeth or a Colorado. Since there were separate negotiations about land forces' strength going on at the same time, and the French army was a cause that was even dearer to France's heart than its navy, and since really there wasn't a budget to build 8 or 10 new battleships anyway, although quite outraged at being demoted on the world stage and being written into the treaty as essentially a third-rate global power, the French government saw little choice but to accept this judgment. Although they did dig their heels in on the subject of submarines and other small craft, as they still thought these might be used to redress the balance. They also rather cunningly used the British insistence on building 2 additional ships, which would become the Nelsons, to counter the Colorado and Nagato classes, to argue that, well, their own fleet was even older than the Queen Elizabeth's and Revenge's that made up the backbone of the Royal Navy battle line, so if the British needed 2 modern ships to ensure that their battle line was up to parity, the French would also merit a special consideration. This managed to gain the Marine Nationale, as well as the Regia Marina, since Italy had piggybacked onto the French piggyback onto the British proposal, 2 concessions. The 3,000 tons of modification that were allowed for older ships were limited for the larger 3 navies to being defensive in nature, i.e. upgrades of deck armour, increases in anti-aircraft guns, and upgrades to torpedo defences, for the most part. Increasing things like belt armour thickness, the number, layout, and calibre of the main guns and various other such offensive systems was strictly forbidden. But for France and Italy, the exception was made that allowed them to use this 3,000 tons to also change up their belt armour or their main battery, assuming that no gun larger than 16 inches was installed. They also got a second concession that the Regia Marina and Marine Nationale could each lay down 2 capital ships of up to 35,000 tons apiece in the late 1920s, in 1927 and 1929 to be precise. This would be ahead of the general end of the construction pause, which was scheduled for 1931. Unfortunately for the Marine Nationale, the first concession ended up not actually amounting to all that much. The Corbeils and Britannias had been built right up to the very smallest of margins to fit within infrastructure limits at the time of their construction, and any significant modification, and both upgrades to 15 and 16-inch guns were briefly considered, would need such a major and massive reconstruction to support them as to be both massively expensive and certain to need substantially more than the 3,000 tons that had been allowed as an increase in displacement. Even adding bulges, a relatively simple torpedo defence upgrade, would cause a slowing of an already slow battle line, and lengthening the hull to compensate for this would again take the ships over the 3,000-ton limit for upgrades. But the reduction in fleet displacement allowance meant that contesting with any of the big three navies was pretty much out of the question, and so the Marine Nationale decided to refocus on potential conflict with Italy. Thanks to pre-war ideas about battle range, where the French had been the most conservative of the large navies, although the Italian battleships all had 12-inch guns, and the Britannias of course had larger weapons, the Italians significantly outranged the French ships due to much better elevation in their turrets. And so most of the post-Washington Naval Treaty work would go into increasing the capabilities of the existing French capital ships' main batteries, with a little bit of work also done on anti-aircraft guns and improving the machinery. But with only 3 or 4 years left before the design of the ship that they could order in 1927 needing to be locked in, the Marine Nationale's design department found itself rather busy with other things, primarily the raft of new cruisers, destroyers, and submarines that were under construction. As the capabilities of new treaty-compliant ships across the world became increasingly clear, French concern shifted to the threat to shipping posed by the new, fast 8-inch armed cruisers, primarily those of the Italian fleet, but also secondarily those of the Japanese, since France still had significant colonial possessions in the Pacific. With Italy seeming to have fairly little interest in working on its own battle line at this point, attention in the Marine Nationale shifted towards using the 70,000-ton allowance for new capital ships, not for a pair of 35,000-ton battleships, but perhaps for some sort of large cruiser suitable for hunting down and overwhelming enemy cruisers. Due to Washington Naval Treaty restrictions, if this ship mounted larger guns than 8-inch, it would have to count as a capital ship anyway, and if this fast, heavily armed cruiser killer sounds a familiar concept to you, it should come as little surprise that the French titled this idea as the Croisière de Bataille. Their first stab at this was a 17,500-ton design. This would allow for the construction of 4 such vessels on 70,000-ton total displacement, and it was supposed to be capable of 35 knots, armed with 8 12-inch 55 caliber guns in a pair of quadruple turrets, both mounted up front, and to be equipped with armour that was capable of resisting 8-inch shells. Speed aside, this was almost exactly the design requirements right down to the displacement of the Invincible-class battlecruisers all the way back in 1905, although the massive increase in speed shows just how far propulsion technology had come. Although these would be excellent ships to deal with modern Washington Naval Treaty cruiser types, their protection, guarded only against 8-inch shells, would mean that they wouldn't really be able to join the battle line, and the French Supreme Naval Council then tried to impose a rule that any new capital ship design should be a precise fraction of 35,000 tons to allow for a homogeneous future fleet, based on the overall allocation to the French Navy. If each ship was 35,000 tons, they could have 5 ships. If each ship was just over 29,000 tons, they could have 6. Or if each ship was 25,000 tons, they could have 7. An effort was made to look at the middle of these three displacements, the just over 29,000-ton limit, which was then confusingly named the Croisière de Bataille de 37,000, which is battlecruiser of 37,000 tons, which of course appears to be 2,000 tons over the 35,000-ton Washington Naval Treaty limit, but it seems that this was a normal displacement calculation using old methods, and if you adjust that to standard displacement, the measure used in the Washington Naval Treaty, by averaging out the percent difference between normal and standard displacement for various other ships of the time period or slightly before, it seems to indicate that the 29,000 and change design had been found non-viable, as the standard displacement of the designs that were actually drawn up would have been around 32,500 tons, which is about midway between the 29,000 ton and a bit limit and the 35,000 ton limit. These ships really resembled scaled-up contemporary French 8-inch cruisers. Their belt armour ranged between 9 and 11 inches thick, depending on how high up the belt you were, and had either a main battery of a dozen 12-inch guns in three quadruple turrets, a pair superfiring forward and one turret aft, with a speed of 33 knots, or half a dozen 16-inch guns in three twin turrets on the same layout, with speed dropping down to 27 knots. All of these designs had extensive space amidships for large recon aircraft. However, the designs fell afoul of three major considerations. One was to do with maintaining the ships. The longer 12-inch armed design would only fit in one set of dock facilities found at Toulon, and then only if a central divider that split the dock in two to allow for multiple ships to be worked on at a time was removed. More to the point, there was only a single slipway that was actually capable of handling the entirety of a hull of that size. That one was at Saint-Nazaire and was soon to be occupied by the hull of the liner Normandy. It would cost as much as two of these ships in their entirety just to upgrade the existing naval infrastructure to allow them to actually be built and then maintained. The second problem was related. Not only would there be a delay in building such ships just to get the infrastructure ready to support them, but the overall cost of the ships plus the infrastructure upgrades would have such a big impact on the rest of the Marine Nationale's building program that several other programs of ships would be set back by years. And thirdly, with the London Conference, which would lead to the first London Naval Treaty coming up, and Italy seeming to be still uninterested in working on its own battle fleet, it seemed politically unwise to be seen to be kick-starting a new naval arms race. In the lead-up to that new conference, the British seemed to be interested in revising down the restrictions of battleships to 25,000 tons displacement and 12 inches of gun calibre. And so a revised ship that met these specifications was quickly sketched. It was capable of only 29 knots, and compared to the previous 12-inch design, the two at-deck level quadruple 12-inch turrets were reduced to triples, and the belt was dropped to about 8 inches. But the conference ended up only agreeing in terms of capital ships to maintain the existing 35,000-ton and 16-inch gun upper limits, and as far as France was concerned, nothing else much changed for ships that were larger than the new heavy cruiser definition. However, since neither France nor Italy had actually ended up using their early build concessions, these were then baked into the new treaty. The two countries could build up to 70,000 tons of brand new capital ships whenever they liked, while the big three navies were taking another 5-year break. There was also some additional tonnage available in theory. The Marine Nationale had lost the battleship France to going aground, and the Italians had never actually gotten around to bringing the Leonardo da Vinci back into service after salvaging it. So they could use that displacement as well. But there were a couple of other pressing issues. The Corbeys were scheduled for retirement pretty soon, and the Germans had just started building an alarming type of commerce raider, the Deutschland-class Panzerschiff, armed in such a way as to be able to take on any treaty-compliant cruiser, but faster than any capital ship, with the exception of the British battlecruisers, and the type therefore would pose a serious threat to French merchant shipping when they entered service, which was kind of the point. That eliminated the 17,500-ton design from any consideration in future running, as it couldn't be given enough armour to deal with the Deutschland's 11-inch guns while retaining its speed and firepower. But a 23,000-ton design was derived from the brief work on the 10-gun 12-inch armed ship just mentioned, as well as drawing on the 17,500-ton design. This displacement seems to have been chosen to allow three ships to be taken from the 70,000-ton allowance, and also happened to closely match the displacement of the lost battleship France, which would then technically allow them to build four. This design actually superficially resembled the 17,500-ton design, with a pair of quadruple 12-inch turrets up front, but it added an extensive 130mm secondary battery to a speed of 30 knots and a 9-inch thick belt, with 5 inches of deck armour over the magazines. After a period of political turmoil in France, which saw nine governments in a little bit under 3 years, was then smoothed out in 1932 with a government that lasted longer than the lifespan of a mayfly, a new requirement was issued for a ship that displaced a little bit more at 25,000 tons, but also used 13-inch or 330mm guns instead of 12-inch. This would also come with another designation, Poisseur de Combat, and it turned out that while pushing displacement up by just over 1,500 tons did allow for a straight-up increase from quadruple 12-inch to quadruple 13-inch, and all the other weights that that entailed in terms of extra magazine space, bigger hoists, thicker armour on the turrets and barbettes, etc., it didn't account for the extra expanse and weight of armour and various other elements that were needed as the ship's hull expanded if you wanted to maintain the ship's fighting capability. And therefore, the design that actually emerged was first 26,000 and then later 26,500 tons. Compared to the earlier design, it was a little longer and a little wider, with belt armour increased initially to 250mm or 9.8 inches, although this would be reduced back to 225mm or 8.9 inches in the last design revision. Deck armour, 140mm or 5.5 inches thick at the thickest point over the magazines, with 8 13-inch guns and a pair of super-firing quadruple turrets mounted forward, and an additional 430mm dual-purpose guns compared to the previous design, for a grand total of 3 quadruple and 2 twin turrets, or 16 guns in total, 1 twin and 1 quad on either side, and a single quad on the centerline aft. The main belt would also be inclined to give some additional protection at longer ranges, and all this cost was about half a knot, with a reduction in speed to 29.5 knots. The extra protection that was given by the increase in thickness and the inclination of the armour made the design, in theory, capable of resisting both German 11-inch and Italian 12-inch shells. And that, in theory, given of course that the primary opposition was supposed to be the Italian battle line, gave the new ship a place in the fast wing of the French battle line. The first ship to this design, the Dunkirk, was duly ordered in October 1932. The Marine Nationale wanted to order more ships as soon as possible, as at the same time as the laying of the keel of the Dunkirk, the Germans had started construction on the 2nd and 3rd Deutschland class, and according to the treaties, they could be expected to build three more of them. But then, in early 1934, the whole idea seemed to be completely upended, as Italy announced that it would be building a pair of 35,000-ton battleships with its 70,000-ton allowance, and the Germans announced the construction of the Scharnhorst class, with more armour and more speed, as well as more and more capable 11-inch guns compared to the Deutschlands. It was quickly decided to take a dual-pronged approach. By this stage, Dunkirk had been under construction for a year and a half, and precious little could be done with her design. But to scrap the idea completely for Strasbourg, the second ship, was to go back to square one with designing an entirely new ship, new guns, and of course more infrastructure upgrades to actually fit a modern 35,000-ton battleship. And so it was decided that Strasbourg would be built to a slightly revised design which would allow her to counter the Scharnhorsts, while in the background a scramble would take place looking for a new 35,000-ton battleship design to counter the Italians, as there was no way that even upgraded Strasbourg could hope to withstand 15-inch gunfire at battle ranges. The project for that would become the Richelieu's. All in all, the core design for Dunkirk and Strasbourg was highly effective, using 8,500 tons standard displacement less than a full-size treaty battleship. The main battery comprised 8 powerful guns that were easily the match of the majority of battleship guns then in service, only ships armed with 15 or 16-inch guns being more powerful. The choice of a pair of quadruple turrets meant that these could be placed at the broadest point of the hull, and of course could all be brought to bear forward, with maximum torpedo defence thickness abreast the magazines, and each turret was in some ways actually a pair of twin turrets that happened to be in very close formation, as an armoured bulkhead ran between the two pairs of guns, designed to keep half the turret operational if the other half happened to be knocked out, assuming, of course, that the hit in question didn't also jam up the training mechanism. The secondary battery allowed for 10 out of 16 guns to be brought to bear on either broadside, and the use of inclined armour gave even Dunkirk protection from the older and smaller capital ship-grade guns found in some of the other fleets, as mentioned. Their speed also meant that they were considerably faster than any other capital ship in the world at the time of their construction, with the exception of Renown, Repulse and Hood. The Congo class had yet to be modernised, and indeed they would remain faster than every treaty-compliant fast battleship, with the exception of their own Richelieu-class successors. They could also operate 3 fairly large scout aircraft, which could be operated in complete safety from the main gun's blast, since the main guns were at the front and the aircraft facilities were at the back. Now, to be fair, there were also a few drawbacks. The belt armour of Dunkirk was not thick enough to be proof against her own guns at expected battle ranges, which is one of the major considerations in what defines a battleship in most design parameters, thus technically rendering her a battle cruiser, albeit a very capable one, by a number of definitions, including my own. Whereas the more heavily protected Strasbourg, which could resist its own firepower to a degree at reasonable battle ranges, therefore tips over to being a battleship under the strict interpretation of that particular rule. Additionally, the 130mm or 5.1-inch secondary guns were supposed to be dual-purpose, and indeed they actually had the elevation and tracking needed for this, but heavy ammunition and a loading system that frequently jammed tended to lessen its actual effectiveness in this role. On Strasbourg, belt armour was increased to 11.1 inches of thickness and inclined at just a fractionally greater angle. The turret armour was increased from 13 to 14.2 inches and the barbette armour went from 12 inches to 13.4 inches, and there were minor increases in armour elsewhere as well. The torpedo defence system was quite impressive, especially for ships of this size, with a defence system that used the liquid-void, etc. alternating system commonly found on most modern ships of the time, but the outer layer was filled with a foamed rubber compound called ebonite mousse that acted much like a liquid layer. The next layer was a void space, but as well as absorbing the shock of impact in the way that a traditional liquid-filled layer would, thanks to the foam also having a degree of air pockets in it, it also served to dissipate some of the shock of the initial impact and explosion, and of course only the bit of it that was actually destroyed by the torpedo could flood, while the rest of that section would remain somewhat buoyant. Dunkirk, launched in October 1935 and commissioned in December 1936, with Strasbourg launching a couple of weeks before her sister commissioning herself in September 1938, although both ships would go on trials for quite some time before being fully accepted into French service. In 1938, both ships were fitted with a funnel cap. Strasbourg got hers right after her commissioning, so if you happen to see a photo of one of these ships without a funnel cap, operating with all its equipment aboard, then you're looking at a photo of Dunkirk in her early years. Both ships then spent most of their pre-war careers working up and undergoing various tests and minor modifications, and as a result, they were both considered new, but with most of the issues associated with being a new ship worked out by the time war was declared on Germany in September 1939. The two were immediately placed into what I'm reliably informed is actually pronounced the Force de Raid, a powerful grouping made up of the 1st Line Division, which was the two Dunkirks, plus 3 modern light cruisers and 8 of the meanest and fastest destroyers in the Marine Nationale's roster. Their goal was to hunt down German raiders. And there honestly was precious little that would be worse for a Deutschland-class to see than Dunkirk and Strasbourg barreling over the horizon blasting La Marseillaise over their loudspeakers, what with all the lyrics about cutting throats and watering the fields of France with the blood of their enemies. In fact, this force was considered so overkill that Strasbourg was soon split off and given a pair of heavy cruisers to be friends with, including Algerie, and then often sent off on separate assignments to Dunkirk and the others. Or the two forces were rotated to keep one of them at sea most of the time. Among these various sweeps were Dunkirk joining up with HMS Hood to go on the hunt for the Scharnhorsts during the latter's first Atlantic raid, the entire force hunting for the Graf Spee, and the various ships involved escorting a number of vital transport convoys or individual ships. However, with growing fears that Italy was about to get involved in the war, it was decided to reconvene the entire force, as well as supplement it with the older battleships Provence and Britannia, along with their escorts, with the entire force based out of Mers el Kebir, where they would have equal access to the Mediterranean or the North Atlantic. Apart from a brief trip back up to Brest in preparation for what turned out to be an abortive mission to Norway, this is where the two ships would stay for the rest of France's active participation in World War II, with the exception of one major deployment when intelligence, which in the end turned out to be faulty, suggested a German formation was going to try and break through the Straits of Gibraltar to link up with the Regia Marina. This, of course, would therefore be where the ships were when the tragedy of the attack on Mers el Kebir unfolded. Although reservists, who made up a minority of the ship's crews, were largely eager to just go home, it appears that enough of the regular crew, and indeed various other French military personnel present, were minded enough to join the British and keep up the fight, to the extent that the Vichy government was actively sabotaging portions of its own military just to stop them being able to defect. For example, the aircraft that were based there had all their tanks emptied of fuel and the air let out of their tyres, with even reconnaissance and training flights forbidden, just in case some of the pilots decided to make a break for Gibraltar. When the British ultimatum ultimately expired, Strasbourg was just about underway, but Dunkirk was still, albeit briefly, tied to the jetty. In short order, she took multiple hits from 15-inch shells, which of course her armour was never designed to protect against, and with her citadel compromised, her rudder disabled, her machinery crippled, she was beached to prevent her sinking. A glancing hit had also happened to knock out the right-hand pair of guns in her super-firing turret. Strasbourg, on the other hand, managed to make good her escape. A turbine failure aboard Hood caused the latter to abort a chase that she was slowly winning, and back at Mers el Kebir, an attempt by Swordfish aircraft to finish off Dunkirk with torpedoes very nearly succeeded. But one of the torpedoes sank a patrol boat that was loaded with depth charges while it was next to the ship, and another torpedo then set off those depth charges, tearing a massive hole in the side of the ship adjacent to the main magazines. In fact, only the fact that the magazines had been flooded when the aircraft first showed up, since the ship was a sitting duck, prevented Dunkirk from being blown in two. Temporary repairs would take about 3 months, using concrete and steel sheeting to make the ship watertight again, and thus allowing her to float. But it would take another 10 months to make her ready to sail under her own power to Toulon, and thanks to the ongoing battles between the Royal Navy and the Regia Marina, she only actually ended up making that voyage in February 1942, over a year and a half after she'd been hit. With Richelieu stuck out at Dakar, and Jean Bart incomplete, Strasbourg had been left as the most powerful unit in the Vichy French fleet. But, under the terms of the armistice, she only occasionally sailed for training exercises. That, of course, leads us up to the end of November 1942, and the German decision to, shockingly, break their word again, this time with the occupation of Vichy France. Dunkirk was in dry dock being refitted, while Strasbourg was pierside. As German tanks forced their way into Toulon, it was decided to scuttle the fleet rather than sail it out, And after a long smashing expedition with hammers that broke pretty much every bit of breakable equipment inside the ships, scuttling charges were set, and most of the crew were sent ashore. The dry dock containing Dunkirk was flooded, and then the charges were blown, with both ships settling to the bottom. In the following years, the Italians tried to salvage some of the French fleet for their own use, but when they eventually drained the dry dock, Dunkirk was found to be in too bad a state to be worth salvaging. Strasbourg was successfully refloated, but then it was decided she too was beyond economical repair. And then the Italians were knocked out of the war and the Germans took over salvage efforts again. In 1944, they decided they agreed with the Italians as regarded Dunkirk and extracted her remains out of the dry dock so they could use it. They, however, moved Strasbourg further away for further consideration, thinking perhaps they could make use of her. But here she was hit and sunk again by American bombers, and both hulks would remain in place until they were scrapped in the mid-1950s.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.